Hey, hi! Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and thanks for downloading this week's show. My guest this week is Pavan Mundi, a Toronto film journalist turned filmmaker whose new movie Diamond Tongues opens this week at the TIFF Bell Lightbox. He's also one of the people behind the excellent film site The Seventh Art, which did some wonderful long-form interview work over the last few years. Pavan's choice for this episode is Groundhog Day, Harold Ramis' remarkable humanist masterpiece disguised as a 90s Bill Murray comedy. You know it. It's the one where Murray plays a jaded weatherman who gets stuck in small-town Punxsutawney on Groundhog Day, only to discover that, thanks to a mysterious time loop, he really is stuck in Punxsutawney on Groundhog Day, waking up every morning at 6 a.m. to find the day waiting for him all over again, along with every annoying obstacle, mishap, and rodent he's already sick of dealing with. It's a touchstone for a generation of comedians, and for a generation period. Kids who came of age in the 90s grew up watching this constantly on cable, with Murray's hapless Phil Connors as sort of their patron saint. Pavan was one of those kids, and you're about to find out just how much Groundhog Day has informed his life and his art. This is Someone Else's Movie. The obvious first question is, why Groundhog Day? What made that pop into your head? Because you're the first person to have even suggested it.
I'm surprised I'm the first person to have suggested it, because that seems like one of those classics that gets thrown around now, don't you think?
I would think so. I mean, certainly, like, generationally, we're doing a bunch of stuff from the early 90s. Seems to be a real touchstone for people, but I wonder if Groundhog Day is one that people... this isn't even the first Bill Murray movie that we've done. We did Quick Change.
Right.
Really early on. And there's something, I don't know, almost religious and delicate about Groundhog Day that people maybe don't want to engage with, in terms of a long conversation.
I think that's true, because it's like such an existential and philosophical film. But I think that's why I picked it. Like, the first time that I saw Groundhog Day, I was very young. Like, I think I was probably 7 or 8, and I watched it probably every year until I was 13 or 14. And at that time, I think it's the first Bill Murray film I really connected with as a child, probably more so than Ghostbusters. And so it always stuck out to me. But I think at that time I was appreciating it for kind of the Harold Ramis elements of it, like the comedic aspects of it, and I wasn't, as an 8-year-old, reading into it philosophically.
Yeah.
But when I was in my early or mid-20s, I kind of went through Bill Murray's filmography and just tried to watch everything in like a one-week period, and it was in revisiting that film where it kind of blew my mind just how dark it gets and how deep it is. Like, I don't know if analyze is, maybe interpret it in a number of different ways in terms of what the point really is. And I think that's why I thought the film would be ripe for discussion.
Yeah.
I remember reading this article about how Harold Ramis and Bill Murray had like a falling out while they were filming the movie. And Ramis had to keep reminding him. It's like, Bill, we're doing a comedy. Because Murray just wanted to keep pushing it in the philosophical, existential direction at the expense of the comedy.
Yeah. It's bizarre. It feels like that's the first step towards new Bill Murray. And this conversation came up in the Aaron Abrams episode as well. You can see what he would become in Groundhog Day in a way that maybe people weren't ready for, which is why it's embraced as a comedy and nobody thinks about it as, you know, I've heard it brought up as a Buddhist allegory. I've heard it brought up as the wheel... someone referred to it as a Zen Koan once, which I thought was kind of a nice way to put it. It's just you are repeating something over and over and over again, but it's your variation that makes a difference. It's you who makes the change.
Right.
And the universe remains indifferent to it. Right up until the end, obviously. He can't change anything. He can't affect anything. Everything will reset and you'll be right back where you started every day, and there's the Sisyphus aspect to it, and also the fact that it is just on a very basic level funny to watch Bill Murray not get what he wants.
Right.
It's one of those perfect storms. I think everything comes together in exactly the right way, and Harold Ramis is so invaluable to it because you can think of a dozen ways every single iteration of this movie could go horribly wrong.
Well, I think the film really benefited from their, like, internal strife. Like, if they didn't have that pre-existing relationship where Ramis could kind of push back on Murray and rein him in a little bit, then the movie could have been terrible. Like, it needed just that amount of tension. And we were talking previously about...
The Polish brothers
who don't filter anything and who can don't walk on eggshells. And I think that's probably what the case was between Ramis and Murray.
Certainly they'd known each other forever.
Of course. Yeah. Although apparently they stopped talking while they were filming the movie.
And that's so sad and weird. I know they apparently had a rapprochement as Ramis was, or before Ramis died.
But right.
In the last weeks of his life, which somehow became a news story, which is just awful, right? But mm-hmm. I guess there's an investment there publicly you need to...
Yeah, it's like a comfort, I think, to people.
Yeah.
Somewhat of a comfort.
And it's such a... And it's such an odd film because, like, watching it doesn't feel like you're watching a drama. It's almost as though Ramis snuck in all the other stuff when no one was looking, at the pitch meeting.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's a movie where Bill Murray repeats the same day over and over again until he learns to be a better person. And you almost don't need a character for Murray to play. You almost don't need a larger surrounding, a larger situation. But that's what Ramis does, I think, really, really beautifully, is that he layers absolutely everything with meaning.
Uh-huh.
To the point where Phil is a human being, not Bill Murray in a different hat. Mm-hmm. I really feel that's a performance.
For sure.
As opposed to something like Scrooged, where, as much as I love Scrooged, because it's just insane, it is Bill Murray playing Bill Murray, playing a character.
Yeah, I think there are elements of Scrooged. Like, I was rewatching Groundhog Day last night, and I feel there were moments where I felt like he was in Scrooge territory, especially early in the film.
Yeah.
But you're right that, like, I think the film was definitely pitched as, you know, the broadest imaginable comedy. And if it came out now, it probably would be, and it was made by somebody else, it probably would be this very, I mean, it's like What Women Want, like, or
right.
like any other number of those, like, magical realism films,
yeah.
like
magical wackiness.
I don't know. I think you have to sneak that stuff in. And I think that's why it's good. Like, for me, when I revisited Groundhog Day, and especially last night watching it again, I mean, that film for me is what I think it's about is Bill Murray or his character, Phil, having to learn how to live. And I think that for whatever reason resonates with me. I think both films I've made are about the same thing, are about the two people who need to learn how to live.
Mm-hmm.
And just this idea that life is hard and it's a struggle and it can be crummy at times, but you have to learn how to get through the day, and that's Groundhog Day is very literally about him having to learn how to get through the day.
Yeah.
And I think that's what sticks with me more than the comedy. I found myself, like, there are some really funny bits in the film, but I didn't find myself laughing that much last night when I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
So much as just being, like, completely engaged and entertained by it. So I think it's those things that Ramis slipped in, kind of probably past the financiers over their heads,
yeah.
that make it a memorable film.
I get the sense that Sony was not... I mean, it was released well. It was given a big push. It was a big... You know, it was a Bill Murray mm-hmm. movie that opened fairly well, as I remember. I get the sense at the time that it was a film that they didn't really consider a world beater. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody, even Ramis, expected it to catch on the way that it did.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a concept comedy with Bill Murray in it, and then it's out and it's over. As opposed to something that is treated... I mean, there was no fanfare for it when it came out.
Uh-huh.
I remember getting the screening invitation. It was the Wednesday night. It was 2 days before it opened. Nothing special. No early word-of-mouth screenings for the media or anything. Mm-hmm. And this was at a point where you could see a film 2 or 3 weeks in advance if the studio really believed in it.
Right.
And so it just sort of came out and happened. And the reception at the press, like the public screening the Wednesday night before, the reception was a little bit muted. Like, the laughter sort of dies away,
uh-huh.
but that's how that works. That's how the movie works. And I think you really do need to see it a second time, or a third, or a fourth, or a fifth,
mm-hmm.
to really understand why it still works, even though it becomes less funny as it goes on, which is sort of the anti-concept of comedy.
Right.
But, so when you were a kid, was it comic all the way through? Like, how did you respond to it the first time?
I think I perceived it comic all the way through. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't thinking any more deeply about it than that. I mean, I thought Bill Murray was funny. There's a lot of stuff in there that is just, on the surface level, it's extremely funny, that I think about differently now.
Yeah.
like the whole idea when he goes on the date with Andie MacDowell, and you just see him, he keeps coming back in and having memorized every single thing about her. I was thinking last night while I was watching it, like how that would be perceived now if this film came out today.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I think people would be up in arms about it because it would be, like, sexually manipulative.
Oh, it absolutely is, yeah. And, and it's that sort of the secret horrible thing about every time travel comedy as well, is that that there's that potential. Like, Primer is basically about people mm-hmm. trying to get things right.
Or, did you see The Cobbler?
Oh, yeah.
The Cobbler. You hate Adam Sandler, right?
I don't hate him personally. You think about Adam Sandler making a movie like this and you get Click. You need someone with depth to pull it off.
Yeah, I mean, although I have a soft spot for any time manipulation movie, and I love body swapping movies.
Sure.
Even no matter how bad they are.
Right.
Like,
The Cobbler is...
I mean, The Cobbler lost me by the end of it, but I didn't think it was horrible.
Okay.
I had, like, a soft spot for it, and, I know there's... The scene I was thinking of last night is the scene where he almost goes in the shower.
Dan Stevens scene, yeah.
Which people were furious about. Like, people were very angry about that scene.
I can see that.
And I can see that, too, but I think it's on par with... But, like, Bill Murray sleeps with that woman he pretends he went to high school with.
Right.
He, like, has sex with her under false pretenses. Like, people would not be happy about that now. It kind of changes the way you view his actions, for sure.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know if they're necessarily condoning his actions. Like, he's supposed to be behaving badly.
Yeah, I think that shows him hitting bottom in a way. Or a number of bottoms. Like, that's the other thing about Groundhog Day that's so wonderful, is there's always another bottom to hit.
That's true.
But in this... Yeah, in that case, part of it is alleviated by the fact that it won't have taken place.
That's true. She won't have to live with it.
Yeah, and you can see the writer kind of maybe making that rationalization in the moment.
Uh-huh.
And hoping the audience does too, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's...
That's
it's
true. Tricky. That's a big difference between that scenario and the Cobbler scenario.
Yeah, I mean, the Cobbler is basically raped by assumed identity.
Yeah.
Or seduction or molestation. It's something creepy.
That's
and this
true.
Is still... Yeah, it's predicated on a lie, and it's not... And it's not right.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie knows it. At least lets us know it. But yeah, and I was going to bring up the example of Ghostbusters, where... Murray's first scene with Sigourney Weaver in her apartment is just horrible. Like, he's basically pickup artisting on her.
Uh-huh.
He's just completely... He puts the moves on her in the most obnoxious way and gets too close and makes her back away. And there's a really kind of icky presence there where it sort of says, like, this is... He's a decent man inside, but first he has to see if people are interested in him by being the worst possible version of himself.
Uh-huh.
And I think only the goodwill we have now towards Bill Murray lets that scene play in the present day.
Right, right.
Groundhog Day, I think, at least establishes an emotional or moral aesthetic where you can kind of get away with bad behavior because it doesn't have to be even realized, let alone forgiven. It'll just be gone.
Although at the end, like, he wins over Andie MacDowell. But by the end of it, he's become like a fake human being. Like, he, depending on how long he's in that time loop for, he's like 40 years older than her now. Like, he has 40 years of experiences, and he's like completely changed who he is, and she's still being heavily manipulated through this.
There is a weird morality at play in a movie that just tells you you have to be, you have to rewrite yourself completely to achieve.
Exactly.
I don't think that's what Buddhism is. Like, no, I don't think the I don't think,
yeah, I don't think it was I don't think
to.
It was written to express like a certain pre-existing philosophy in that way. I think it's like a lot more ambiguous than that. But I think it's also interesting seeing like the 90s ideal of what life was like, what is right, and you know, for him it's all about having this like a very conventional relationship and like, I watched it yesterday after reading this think piece on Trainwreck.
Okay.
Did you read that?
Which I still haven't seen, so no.
Okay, I haven't seen it either, but, like, IndieWire wrote this really, like, harsh article about how it is very conventionally moral and how it betrays what Amy Schumer's act is really all about.
Oh,
and it's kind of slut-shaming by having this idea that the only way you can be an adult is by having a mature monogamous relationship with someone and not drinking and like throwing out all your booze. And
that's so that kind of
thing, which is very consistent in Apatow's films. Like, the Knocked Up is the same way.
Yeah.
And like, it's always about, you know, growing up in a very conventional in a very conventional way.
Yeah. I thought This Is 40 did a really good job of showing that the lie behind that, that everyone's mm-hmm. uncomfortable and hiding things from each other in the, in that committed relationship.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's also the only film where he really engages with that.
So, yeah, This Is 40, like, for some reason I just didn't connect with that film. That's the, like, I'm a pretty diehard Apatow fan. Like, Trainwreck is the first one I haven't seen on opening weekend.
Okay.
Just because I've been busy. Like, I hope to see it soon. But This Is 40, I don't know if it's because I'm not 40, that I couldn't relate to it in any way.
Yeah.
It just felt like his most Cassavetes movie.
Yeah. I don't know that that's a bad thing.
No, like, it's not a bad thing, but I felt it was much harder to watch.
Mm.
And it didn't, usually he supplements, like, because Apatow is diehard Cassavetes fan, and he's just philosophically doing the same thing that Cassavetes was doing.
Yeah.
But that one feels like it's not supplemented with comedy, enough comedy to make it worthwhile. Like, the supporting cast is pretty thin compared to other Apatow films.
It's funny, and that makes me really want to see Trainwreck, because it does feel like he's getting away from a concept of comedy, much like, I guess, James L. Brooks is sort of doing, mm-hmm. or has done already, or mm-hmm. Cameron Crowe, where they, like, well, I think with Crowe, he thinks he's still making comedies, but they're just not landing. And with Apatow, there's definitely a sense that he's just exploring whatever the hell he wants to explore, and sometimes there's a movie in it. So I'm really curious to see Trainwreck, because it's written by someone else and therefore has different values, or at least a different value set to begin with.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I think from, like, the thing that I had read, apparently it feels like an Amy Schumer movie that Apatow took and applied his philosophies onto, and, like, added this moral compass to it.
Interesting.
Which, like, all his films are about, like, wanting to be loved, or finding out how to be loved, or, like, all the shit that gets, like, I can swear, like, all the shit that gets in the way of love. And I think Groundhog Day is kind of like that as well.
Yeah, Groundhog Day is, I mean, I was going to say, it's a very George Bush movie, mm-hmm. in a weird way. It's sort of the back, like, how did he, it was Reagan who appropriated Back to the Future and said he wanted to take America, you know, back to the glory days that it never really had.
Right.
Bush was just sort of dutifully carrying that out. So with Groundhog Day, there's a sense that small town living is the, like, let's never leave. Mm-hmm. It's the only place that matters. It's the real America.
Right.
Although, of course, the real America is filled with horrible rodents and Stephen Tobolowsky and all these frustrations and things that Phil ultimately has to learn to love, mm-hmm. in order to be freed of the cycle, but to remain there. Like, you have to eliminate all your big city ways in order to learn to love.
That's true, because he has to, it's that existence that gets him out of the time loop. But that makes me think, like, it's interesting that he doesn't just have to win over the girl and, like, become, you know, a great like, partner.
Yeah.
He has to win over the entire town, and he has to, like, he, by the end of it, he knows every single person in town, knows everything about them. And so I think it's, like, part of it, I think, is kind of pushing this idea of being interested in other people, which, I mean, is a good thing, but it's, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot to, like, be that engaged with everyone you encounter.
Yeah, and it takes work.
Yeah. I mean,
like, thousands of days of work.
Yeah.
Which is the other thing that, just to introduce the other great time loop movie of recent years, Edge of Tomorrow, which could not exist, I suspect, if Groundhog Day didn't exist.
No, I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same exact thing.
But it even assumes that we know what's going on in Edge of Tomorrow because we've seen
Groundhog
Day, which is
for
remarkable.
Sure.
Like, just, this is a, Groundhog Day is a film that, I mean, there had been time loop films or time loop concepts before. There's 12:01 p.m. or a.m., the student film that became a feature film that isn't very good. Mm-hmm. There's got to be at least two Twilight Zone episodes about this.
Uh-huh.
And what you get is, in Groundhog Day, a film that assumes that without any explanation, without any logic, or, well, I mean, there's logic, but without any rational explanation or even pseudoscientific, you know, he doesn't even drive through a storm.
Right.
The storm is coming. But there's, that's not what it is. There's no sense whatsoever that there's a reason for this happening, which is so great, because we're in as much of a mystery as he is.
That's very interesting, because there's almost always, there is that reason. Like, in What Women Want, he gets electrocuted.
Right.
He, like, falls in the bathtub.
Yeah, Freaky Friday, we're told what has to happen in order for
people
to change
bodies. Even Big is the fortune teller.
Magic wish.
Yeah, that's right.
And
that's
Groundhog Day, just don't piss off the universe.
I wonder if that's the only magical, wacky movie without like a inciting incident to create the loop.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, yeah, the whole plot, the other one, 1201, is it AM or PM? But it's an end of the world kind of thing where there's about to be the time loop is created because of a scientific experiment that's gone wrong, and so one of the scientists working on it has become immune because he got a little shock, and now he has to stop the thing from happening over and over and over again.
Uh-huh.
That's all about the plot mechanism. It's right. all about the mechanics of what's going on. Groundhog Day, like, it really doesn't matter.
Right. Like, I mean, he never really tries to reverse it at any point.
Yeah.
Just, like, he tries to kill himself.
Which is actually a completely reasonable... I mean, it's, you know, a mouse trapped in a maze doesn't know why it's in the maze.
Mm-hmm.
He goes through these incredible levels of despair, and even the point where he's no longer trying to kill himself, but just sort of going through the motions. I mean, I want there to be one day where he reads and just doesn't do anything else.
I was thinking the one thing we don't see him do, which I think that doesn't happen because of like you need to have some level of suspension of disbelief, but surprised he doesn't try to travel outside of the town, because then he could just go to a different city every single day and lead a completely different day,
right?
And break out of that monotony.
I can see why you wouldn't do it in the movie.
No, he'd be on a plane for like 4 hours.
Yeah, and it would be incredibly expensive to set all the locations up. But yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, you've had time to think this through. Like, what would you have done differently that the film doesn't?
That's probably the only thing I would have done differently is like tried to travel and see a different existence. But I mean, like all the things he does, and I think this is why the film is probably successful, is I think it's what a lot of people would do with no consequences. It's essentially like he's living Grand Theft Auto before Grand Theft Auto was a game, essentially.
Yeah. And with no consequence of death or even, I mean, arrest is pointless. He'll just, you know, I guess the trick would be to stave off the arrest until the last possible minute. So you'd want to do anything right up until like 3 a.m. when you can just go to your cell and have a nap.
Yeah. Otherwise, yeah, you'd be in jail all day.
The whole day.
Yeah. Well, even though that's not too bad. Wouldn't be too bad.
I guess, especially if you know but maybe that's it too. You don't know that this is your last day. Like, there is the sense that, you know, by the time it finally does end, it's a surprise. It's a legitimate surprise to
him. Yeah.
Because this is your reality. But I think, like, my first couple of years in the loop would be a little careful. Like, what if I do, if you do rob a bank and then that's your reality. You wake up in prison and on trial.
That's
your
true.
Your only defense is you run, or I didn't think I was going to be here.
That's true. Like, now that I'm thinking about it, that you bring it up, I mean, it's great that he never knows what he has to do to end the loop. Like, he doesn't know that he has to fall in love and be a nice and better person to do that. And I think that makes it a more genuine realization. Whereas if, you know, he had someone who was constantly telling him he's a bad person, like a ghost, and he needs to change his way, like another great, but not a body swapping, but like magical wackiness movie, The Family Man, the Nicolas Cage one, where he has Don Cheadle like yelling at him and telling him that he has to like learn to love his new life.
Yeah,
I love that movie. I think that movie's great.
I think that's a uniquely Brett Ratner proposition, which is that you learn to love all the things that are then taken away from you, and that's okay. You'll get more.
Yeah,
like, that's a movie made by a guy with money
for sure,
who's never really worried about where the next thing is going to come from. But yeah, that's Cage, one of the rare real dramatic performances from Cage, like post action movie Cage.
That's true. Was that post? That was post The Rock.
Mid, really. Like, it was 99 or 2000, so...
Right.
He'd already made the big ones, like The Rock and Gone with 60 Seconds and Con Air.
Uh-huh.
Maybe Gone in 60 Seconds was the same year. But it was definitely post the really big $20 million pictures.
Uh-huh.
And so, Taya Leone was so good in that. Yeah.
Oh, she was great. What happened to Taya Leone? What is she? Was she in the James L. Brooks... was that Spanglish? Was she in that?
I think so, yeah. And then she was in, I think her last big film was Ghost Town, which coincided
another with... Another magical wackiness film. There's a lot of them. Like, I was thinking they don't make them anymore, but I guess they do. They're just kind of flying under the radar.
Yeah. I think television sort of co-opted it for a while. Stuff like Wonderfalls and Joan of Arcadia.
Right.
Just became easier
Pushing
to
Pushing Daisies.
Of, yeah, play out the concept for as long as you possibly can.
Uh-huh.
But there'll be more. There's always going to be an appetite for fairy tale qualities in movies, I think, because we still kind of want that fantasy.
Uh-huh.
And even Groundhog Day is the kind of movie that really takes pleasure in showing you that it would not be a dream come true, that this is not a pleasant situation.
Yeah.
You are in hell until you figure out that it's not hell. But philosophically, that's a much easier thing to pitch as Bill Murray is stuck in the small town on Groundhog Day forever.
Uh-huh.
Then this is a psychological, quasi-religious examination of how a human being adjusts to a never-changing landscape.
Yeah, and I think they were smart about, like, even when it's at its darkest, I think it's still darkly funny. Like, I think maybe the funniest shot in the film is when he's jumping off the building. It's such a ridiculous shot, and it's so serious, and the music is just insane, and he's so desperate that it just it can't not be funny.
Yeah.
I think I laughed the hardest probably at that scene.
For me, it's the gracefulness of his movements with the toaster in the bathtub.
Yeah.
He's just, it's practiced. We know this isn't even the first time he's done it.
Yeah.
And that's what's so great about Murray, is that you can put him in that situation and say, for the next 10 minutes, Bill Murray is going to commit suicide over and over and over. And that's all you need. Like, I'm in. Show me what happens.
Yeah.
He's just magnificent. And it is perfect casting. I can't imagine. You can sort of picture it as a thought experiment with some other people.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was just thinking of now. It's like, who else could have done that?
I mean, Steve Martin, probably.
Yeah, maybe.
He's so much better at panic than he is at redemption.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know that you could earn the ending with someone like that. And I love Steve Martin.
Uh-huh.
But no one wants Steve Martin to be the hero and the nice guy. You want him to be bigger and broader.
Yeah.
And I don't know that his personality could handle... Like, Roxanne is as close as it gets. He's playing a normal person with a ridiculous nose.
Mm-hmm.
But the ridiculous aspect of it is what defines the normal aspect. And
right.
With Groundhog Day, you need him to be the same guy, consistently normal, and go through stages. And uh-huh. Murray does that like he's just working his way through the musical scale. It's just incredible, subtle frustration and anger and glory and joy and silliness.
Yeah, it's like an insane amount of range. Like, I wonder if there's even like a young, like, is there a next Bill Murray? Has anyone even ever been referred to as the next Bill Murray?
No.
I feel like that just doesn't exist. Like, kind of comedy just doesn't grow on trees.
I'm gonna snap back to Apatow. I think Paul Rudd could do it. Because I think Paul Rudd can do anything. And also, his personality is so stable. Like, his type is so stable. In Ant-Man, he's not even acting, I'm pretty sure. He's just... It's the same thing they did with Downey in Iron Man. You cast the actor and put the suit on him and let him do whatever the hell he wants.
Yeah.
And I think Rudd could find ways to play comic frustration and that sort of thing. Although, you know, my other go-to is Michael Shannon, who would be incredible
in a
Groundhog Day situation, although I just don't think it would be fun.
Well, he's in Groundhog Day. Right, Michael Shannon.
I can't cope with that knowledge. Like, my brain can't accommodate the fact that he's in that.
Yeah, he looks totally different.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's shocking. When I first realized it, it's insane.
Yeah, well, it's like seeing him in 8 Mile, which was 10 years later.
Right.
It's just like, holy, but in 8 Mile, he's him. Like, he's the Michael Shannon I recognize, the guy that I know.
Yeah.
We should talk about the supporting cast, because it is phenomenal. I mean, this is also one of the three or four movies that Andy McDowell is really perfect in, as opposed to strange and awkward and looking like she doesn't know what she wants to do.
Yeah, I haven't seen too many Andy McDowell movies. Was she in Four Weddings and a Funeral?
Four Weddings and a Funeral, where she's okay.
Yeah.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape, where she's great.
Yep.
And she's also having a lot of fun in Magic Mike XXL.
Oh, I haven't seen
Magic Mike. She's sort of the secret weapon in the second act.
Oh, really?
And other than that, she's had some films that haven't served her very well.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to say she's limited, because that's not fair. She has a range. She's not always cast in ways that serve her range.
Mm-hmm.
And in Groundhog Day, it's perfect for her, because she really just has to sort of roll back on her heels the whole time and assess things. And that can translate into awkwardness or unpreparedness in some films, where it just feels like she's just wandered into the movie.
Uh-huh.
You know, as much as I love Hudson Hawk, not her best moment.
Right.
But what she does in this is she sort of has to figure out where Murray is coming from all the time, which kind of makes her our surrogate, too, because she is how we gauge his levels of despair or happiness from scene to scene. We can sort of measure how weird this behavior is for him by how she responds to him.
Right. That's true. She's like the barometer.
Yeah. The emotional barometer.
For sure.
But it is, you know, it's an essential... Like, it's an instructional film, in a way, for how to make a fantasy, for how to make a film with restrictions, narrative restrictions, rather than budgetary restrictions, because obviously they put their money into the town and then they have the entire movie.
Right.
But it's a great example of a movie that is self-contained and has to be, and finds new ways to I mean, even the fact that the certain shots are repeated becomes a running gag. It's not a limitation. It's not the same setup. It's the, oh, this is happening again.
Right. It'll just, like, jump cut to the same location.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is so daring in a weird way for its time. And this is a point where, you know, like, the alternate, the dark version of this movie, or not the dark version, to my mind, the bad version of this movie would be the M. Night Shyamalan version.
Right.
Where it's deadly serious. It's suffocating with panic over the character being trapped in a situation, and there are so many other ways this could have gone wrong, but conceptually it's just, I keep coming back to that Bill Murray in Repeating a Day. That's like, it's a bulletproof premise, and Ramis was exactly the right guy to execute it
for sure.
So did you notice anything did you notice anything different this time, this last viewing, or how did you respond to it specifically?
I was surprised how well I remembered it, because I haven't seen it in a couple years, and since I revisited it like 5 or 6 years ago, I've tried to watch it every year or so. It's like become one of the films that it's a winter movie, and I love winter movies as well, and there's just something strangely comforting about watching a winter movie, although I don't know if that town was shot on, like, if that was shot on a soundstage or if that's a real...
It feels like a location.
Yeah.
But that's because they...
Punxsutawney is not a real town, right?
I don't know. I should probably just check
that. I wonder. Yeah, I think what maybe struck me was this time was just how absurd the idea of Groundhog Day is. Like, if aliens were observing our planet on Groundhog Day, like, they would think we're completely insane. Right.
They may be right.
Like, the Groundhog Day ball, like, they have a ball at the end, or banquet... It's like, man, this town, like, really takes this Groundhog Day really seriously.
Yeah. Well, the rituals, I mean, that's why he's there, right? That's the whole, that's the lure in the first place, is that it's such a weird, he's there, he's the alien. He's sort of there to mock them for their practices and their giant killer rodent.
But there's that scene where he's in the bar talking to those two, like, blue-collar guys.
And
he's like, oh, imagine if your life had no meaning, if it didn't matter what you did today. And if there's no real tomorrow, and the guy who's just horribly depressed is like, I know, that's like what I feel like, which is, I think, in a way, kind of the point of the film. Like, it's a very literal depiction of how I think people can take that away from the film. Like, that for a lot of people, they do feel that way when you're like caught in a rut.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised they went there, that they, because I think that's, and it's an obvious metaphor for, you know, spinning your wheels or just, I don't know. I keep going back to this idea that it's just trying to say that life is a struggle unless you can adapt to it or find a philosophy of living to get through it. And
yeah, find the thing that makes it work.
Exactly. And find the thing that breaks the time loop, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes it feel like a new day. That makes you feel like, that's deep. I mean, that's remarkably deep. But that's, of course, the point, right? There's an unexpected depth in everything, including Punxsutawney, which does not exist. I just checked. It was filmed in Woodstock, Illinois.
Oh.
And the interiors were shot in Cary, Illinois. And I don't know where that is, but I'm assuming they're both fairly close to
that
Chicago.
That makes sense. Yeah, so like Ramis loved Chicago.
Yeah, he was a big Chicago guy.
And John Hughes, big Chicago.
That's true. Even John Hughes wouldn't have had an idealized Punxsutawney, I think. He was all suburbs. And this is that longing. This is that Reagan-era longing. It's like Hill Valley, California. You have to have a specific need to go back to small town, simpler life.
Uh-huh.
Like, just wait. I'd love to see... A sequel's a terrible idea, but I would love to just look at Punxsutawney now and see if that it's like whether it's been overrun by hipsters who've come in and gentrified it, or if it's still exactly as it should be in the movie's argument, which is small and intimate. I don't want to know what happened to Phil. I don't think that's even important.
No, I mean, they kind of leave him in a place where I think if the when I was watching it, and I would like, I remembered how the movie ends before I watched it last night.
Sure.
And I was thinking, you know, if there's one thing that probably bugs me about the film, it's that his victory at the end is too big, where he kind of gets everything out of it. He gets the girl. He's become a completely new person. And generally, for me, I always prefer when the victory at the end is small, which is kind of like an Apatow thing. Like, they don't get what they want. They get what they need.
Right.
And he gets what he wants. But then when I was watching it last night, I was thinking relative to what he actually goes through in that film, whether it's 10 years or 30 years or 10,000 years. And I've read, like, Hilgrimus say each one of those things, like, at various points of his career, like, however long it is. The victory isn't that big, like, relative to what he goes through. It's still kind of a small victory.
Yeah, it's just
like,
a release.
He's literally tortured. Like, he goes through torture just to, like, get the girl. And so I think the ending, I appreciated the ending more than I thought I would, just philosophically speaking. I don't think they're handing him everything at the end of the film or wrapping things up in a bow.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way that it may seem like on the surface.
Yeah, he still has to live now.
Yeah.
Like, he's found every interesting thing about... And I kind of wonder about that. Like, he's found every interesting aspect of Punxsutawney by now.
Mm-hmm.
Is anything going to surprise him? Is there even... When he says, let's never leave, I just like, oh, Stockholm Syndrome. You can't imagine an existence beyond these walls.
Right. I mean, he's lived as long as you can live. But, like, what now? What's next?
Yeah.
What do you do when you've done everything?
Yeah. Although now he speaks French and plays piano, so presumably he has marketable skills.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So, yeah, the last question on the episode is always the same, which is, you know, so what elements of the film, if any, have you incorporated into your own work, writing, directing, or even just working with people in a collaborative sense? Like, is there anything from Groundhog Day that you use?
I think we kind of touched on it a little bit already, which is just, like, I feel that the two films I made, if you boil them down, are about the same kinds of things that Groundhog Day is about, but I don't know if that's unique to Groundhog Day. I think there's a lot of films that are about just trying to get the main character on the right path. And with, like, Diamond Tongues, we talked a lot about how if you look at the conventional arc of a film about an actress, like Tootsie or something, all of what happens in Diamond Tongues happens before that film would even start. It's like at the very beginning.
Right.
And it's just trying to get the character on the right path and not necessarily give them everything that they need. And kind of talking about Groundhog Day, I think Bill Murray's character ends up on the right path at the end of the film. He's become somewhat of a better person. And although Diamond Tongues is about someone who does horrible things, I don't think Edith is a horrible person. And we try to leave her in a place where she has the tools, where she can live a better life, because she's learned something. And we're not trying to, you know, show her now as a successful actress at the end, but because that's besides the point. Like, whether or not she's a successful actress doesn't even matter. It's about her being able to live with herself and to get through the day. And I think that Groundhog Day, among a number of other films, it's put me in that headspace where that's what I'm thinking about all the time. And, you know, I'm trying to get another film made right now, and that's already written. And I think that shares a lot of the same themes. It's you know, it's about the same idea of just trying to find a way to get through the day, which, you know, isn't that what Groundhog Day is all about in a very literal sense?
Yeah, no, it's thematically, absolutely. And plus, it's the mission statement of Groundhog Day, which remains unknowable, you know, is, I think, ultimately, it's my own life credo, which is just don't be an asshole.
Yeah.
And so you have to watch Bill Murray go from one to not being one and hope that he maintains it in a way that makes the suffering worthwhile. So I like the implicit threat in the movie that if you are unworthy of the life you have, the universe will find a way to punish you for it, even though it's not a philosophy I subscribe to.
Uh-huh.
It's just basically, you know, karma, you've got it coming.
Right. I mean, it's kind of a very, it's anti-cynicism.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
It's like, and I think especially that period of early 90s films, and I think I think you're probably having a lot of people bringing up 90s films, and people are like, the 90s is very in vogue right now. And even like, I like watching old commercials on YouTube from like the 80s and 90s, and there's just no cynicism whatsoever. And the commercials aren't even trying to be these like pithy jokes. Like, every commercial now is a joke. Like, it always ends in a punchline.
Yeah.
It's never funny, and nobody ever finds them funny. But the commercials in the 80s and the 90s are just filled with this enthusiasm, and they're not cynical at all. And it just has this optimism to them. Like, there's a commercial I saw for, I think it was Lens Crafters or something.
Okay.
And it's just a guy dancing through the streets while this insane song is playing. Like, it sounds kind of like the Groundhog Day opening theme music.
Okay.
Which is amazing, by the way. Like, I don't think we see that in comedies anymore, which is like a song written with lyrics directly relating to the plot about the weatherman.
Yeah.
And
that's true. I can't think of the last time a movie actually used soundtrack music, like a cut to comment. Sometimes you get the ironic juxtaposition, but yeah, direct commentary just doesn't happen anymore.
No, like you would never see that in like Neighbors or Trainwreck, like someone crooning about
what you're actually seeing.
Yeah, about what you're seeing.
Yeah.
But there is like this real innocence to it, and I think the 90s we remember it as a simpler time, whether it was or not, who knows, like but we view it that way in hindsight, especially because it's like, we didn't even talk about how if you made Groundhog Day now, like, what implication the internet would have. Like, he could wreak havoc on the world with this, like, being caught in this time loop. Like, the number of things he could do.
God, I'm thinking about a possible clue to the situation, because you could repeat over and over again of the scene of him looking things up, and one day it changes and there's a new different indication that someone else is experiencing the same thing.
Right.
That's, like, that's Edge of Tomorrow level stuff, and mm-hmm. I don't think it would help. I think the internet, like so many things, the addition of the internet to a movie would solve a lot of essential problems and create new ones in the storytelling.
Right. I think maybe that's why it seems like there's less movies like this, because they require too much suspension of disbelief. Like, I think The Cobbler, I would assume, never mentions the internet in any way.
I don't think so. I can't remember.
Like, you just have to pretend that it exists in a world without the internet. Otherwise, you could poke too many holes in the concept.
Yeah. I think Dan Stevens looks at his phone a couple of times. That's as close as it gets.
Uh-huh.
And there's always this whole antiquated concept, too, that a cobbler wouldn't have use of the internet. Like, he wouldn't need things like the newfangled telephone and automobile. But yeah, I think also it would just deflate the isolation. Like, the sense that Punxsutawney is a tiny little space, and maybe, you know, I'm thinking of Vincenzo Natali's Nothing, where there is nothing else to do, there is nowhere else to go but the house in which it's set. Groundhog Day is just sort of an extrapolation of the same, well, I mean, Groundhog Day came first, but it's an extrapolation of the premise, which is there is nowhere to go but where you already are.
Right, and they do the blizzard to, like, emphasize that he has to stay. Like, he's literally, I guess they put that in to force him there.
You need a geographic restriction, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Although, but of course,
The idea that he's a weatherman and he's, like, by definition, all-knowing and can predict the future, I think is, like, maybe serendipitous. Like, obviously they made him a weatherman because he would be reporting on Groundhog Day.
Right.
But, like, the other implications of that, like, his job is to know what's coming tomorrow.
Yeah.
And in a way, he does end up knowing, but there is, like, I think he literally says there is no tomorrow at one point.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's just, it's so rich. Like, the film just has so much that you could read into.
Yeah, I just want to make sure we give the proper credit to Danny Rubin, who wrote the original script before Ramis got on and rewrote it. Because that is a brilliant idea. I don't know who came up with what. I'm not that well versed with the history of the film, but it's a great script. Like, as it exists, it's a fantastic script, and the bones of it are just so solid that I'm assuming they must have been there all along.
Yeah, I read that. So Rubin wrote the script, and then Ramis rewrote it, and then while they were on set, and Ramis had a falling out with Murray, they brought the original screenwriter back on set because Murray refused to talk to Ramis, so he had to work with Murray, and they were rewriting together, and then he would go to Ramis, and then they would rewrite together. Like, it was just so convoluted and full of so much tension, which is just remarkable, because you don't really hear that often of films that are filled with so much strife and animosity that turn out good.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird, because there are films where clearly, I always think of Bedtime Story, the Brando-Niven collaboration, which led to Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. It was remade as that. Bedtime Story is one of those unbearably stiff and dead films where every single story is how much fun the actors were having. Oh, we were making faces. We never wanted to stop shooting. We had dinner on the set. It was delightful. And you see the movie and it's a dead thing. And sometimes things need to go wrong in order to get the best result.
Yeah, that sounds like the opposite of the Cassavetes model, which is just getting the crew drunk and loose and like having as much fun as possible and hoping that bleeds on screen.
Yeah.
But it shows also that there's no guarantees either way. Like, yeah. You can't just get your crew drunk and then think it's going to be like a great,
yeah, great film. I just, you know, it's a standard rule. If you're using real alcohol in the shot, you're just, you know, it's 50-50. Anything can happen.
We did that a lot. And like, we used real alcohol all the time for everything. Yeah.
And how did that play?
I mean, very well. Like, for a lot of the film, Leia is drunk. Like, because we were using the last take, like, there's a scene where she's in a bar and she's talking to this performance artist and he's like trying to pick her up. And we actually modeled that scene after the Woman Under the Influence scene, where Mabel's like really drunk at the bar and she like picks up the guy. And we used the last take, and Leia was like completely wasted. It was 6 o'clock in the morning, and she was doing two shots of whiskey in every take. And I think we did six takes.
Oh my God.
So she did 12 shots of whiskey. We shot the scene. The last take was the best take because she was actually drunk and like forgetting her lines. And then I had to go to my apartment to pick something up before we went to the next location. And she came in and vomited in my bathroom.
Oh God.
And then we moved on and we continued shooting.
Right. I mean, I know she's a rock star. I know this is what you do, but that's still,
I know.
Sacrifices for art.
Yeah. Well, I think it worked out. Like, I can't deny that, it was for the betterment of the film, but it's totally 50-50. It's a risk, for sure.
My thanks to Pavan Mundi, whose new feature, Diamond Tongues, co-directed with Brian Robertson, opens at the TIFF Bell Lightbox in Toronto this Friday, August 7th. It'll hopefully expand across Canada in the coming weeks, and until it does, maybe check out Pavan's first solo feature, Every Day is Like Sunday, streaming on Netflix now, or flip through the archives at the7thart.org. where you'll find a wealth of video essays and video interviews with everyone from Bruce MacDonald and Patricia Rosema to Costa Gavras and Paul Schrader. You can also follow Pavan on Twitter at Pavan Mundi, PavanMoondi. Groundhog Day is available on Blu-ray and DVD from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment and for rental and purchase on iTunes and Google Play. It is great, and even if you've seen it 10,000 times, it's worth another look. As always, you can find me online on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or on the interwebs at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, I would love to read it. Thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.